Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, your backstage pass to revealing conversations with stars, creators, and industry leaders on Broadway, off-Broadway, and beyond. I'm Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, we're talking about the new Broadway musical, The Notebook, a title that's probably already got you picturing Rachel McAdams and Ryan Gosling embracing in the rain. That image comes from the 2004 movie adaptation of Nicholas Sparks' massively popular 1996 novel about the tribulations and triumphs of a lifelong love affair. In a crowded spring season on Broadway, The Notebook arrives in New York carrying a stamp of approval from enthusiastic critics and audiences who saw the show in its world premiere in Chicago in 2022. With me in the virtual studio are the writers of The Notebook, singer-songwriter Ingrid Michaelson, and playwright and screenwriter Becca Brunstetter. The two of them join me to talk about giving fans the iconic moments they love, making choices that tell the story in the most universal way, and making sure that onstage rainstorm really satisfies. Hello, Ingrid and Becca. Thanks for joining me.
Hello.
Hi.
So, Ingrid, you and I talked a little while back, and you told me about how you got involved in The Notebook, and I don't want to mischaracterize it, but is it fair to say you stalked your way into this job? Like, you were really committed to this job and you really wanted it. Can you tell us a little bit about why that was and what really resonated with you so much in the story?
Yeah. I mean, I guess stalked is a strong word. it's in the stalking family, for sure. I met with one of the producers, Kevin McCollum, and we were talking about the fact that I wanted to write a musical, and he thought The Notebook would be a interesting title for me. And I thought that meant I was hired when he kind of pointed at me and said The Notebook. And I thought, oh, that's how they do it in Broadway. And then I proceeded to write multiple songs, and I just kept sending them to him. And eventually he thought, well, I should hire this woman, I guess, because she keeps sending me these songs unsolicited. and that's kind of how I squeezed my way into the world of Notebook by just writing and writing and writing and writing, which is kind of how my Notebook journey continued. I overwrote, you know. And then you end up having to, we call it throw your babies away, you know, like, oh, I love that one, but it doesn't make sense anymore. But yeah, that the story resonated with me. I think the story resonates with anybody who has a beating heart, unless you're, you know, a curmudgeon. I love romance. I love enduring love. I love the idea and the concept of time and patience and working hard to keep your relationship going. I lost both of my parents, so the element of loss is just extremely interwoven into my very existence, and everything I create is tinged with that. And so the story, just from multiple angles, really hits me in a very personal way. And I really, from the moment he pointed at me, I just knew I had to be the one to write the music for this.
And you had seen the movie, is that right? Is that how you knew the story?
Yes, I saw the movie when it was on, you know, VHS, and I rented it at Blockbuster with my friend. And I was in my, you know, probably 21, 22, and, you know, wept and wept at the end, because that's what I do. That's what I do best. Write music and cry.
Are any of those initial songs still in the show?
Yes, the very first one I wrote.
Oh, great.
The very first one I wrote and I sent to Kevin is now the penultimate song in the show. Yeah.
And so when was this that you were first starting to get involved?
This was January 2017.
Okay, great. And so, Becca, what about for you? How did you get involved in the project? And did you also know The Notebook? Know and or love it?
Yeah, I mean, I too, I think my story is also a bit tinged with stalkerness, in the sense that my agent, literally just overheard Kevin talking about it. Is either my agent or my lawyer, David, I can't remember. Somebody overheard Kevin talking about it and they called me the next day and said, this sounds like something you might really be interested in. We've since moved the story, but the original book that the movie's based on takes place in North Carolina, my hometown. I have a lot of Alzheimer's in my family as well. So there were a lot of things that I immediately connected to, and it didn't take long for me to know with all of my being that I really wanted to do it. It just took listening a few of Ingrid's first songs, and her first songs that she wrote for it made it really clear the tone of the musical, the scope of the musical. And without having met Ingrid, but having loved her music for many years, I just knew that we would align and have a shared vision. And I had definitely seen the movie. I had when young women watch that movie, you get kind of poisoned because you think this is what love is. He builds you a house, you know? So I don't remember when I first saw it, but it lives rent free in my brain. And, I've always loved it. It's a beautiful story. I really love intergenerational stories. So it's always been one that I've loved to watch.
Yeah. And so how did the two of you work? It sounds like some songs existed before you came on, Becca. And then tell me a little bit about kind of how that process of collaboration was in terms of here's a song that exists, let's write around it, or we think this moment needs a song, can you write a song for it? Like, what's that balance?
I feel like that was a pretty equal balance, I would say. Mm-hmm. I had a handful of songs. Some of them we quickly realized, oh, we don't see them when they're in this time period. So this song, and Becca, bless her heart, would try to make something work. But I think a huge thing I learned in this process is letting go is equally as important as creating something, or to know when to let go of something. And so, it was like a ball of yarn kind of unrolling in front of us. Like the ball was telling us kind of where to go. I don't know how else to explain it. To use a very overused word, organically happened. And if there was a moment where our directors felt, oh, this should be musicalized, and then I would go into the other room and musicalize it and come back and have some song bits to show people. This was during, I think, our very first, in 2019, we had our very first sort of showing of it in Vassar, elements of it. But then sometimes I would have a song and I like Middle Alley's big moment, her big song. I've gone through three versions of that song because every time I would live with it one for a while, I'm like, well, I don't really like that one. I want to kind of best myself. And so I think for me personally, it was a mix of Becca's writing and where she took us, what the directors were telling me the story needed, and then me trying to just one-up myself.
Yeah. Becca, for you, was there a particular challenge in telling this story within the sort of structures or kind of conventions of a musical? Like, how did you think about translating what had been a book and a movie into the musical we see now?
Well, to me, it instantly felt so theatrical. So it wasn't, once we decided early on, we're going to make the musical, we're going to make a piece of theater. We're not going to try and put the movie on stage. We're not going to try and put the book on stage. That allowed me to embrace it as a play. And early on, you know, we certainly didn't invent the concept of splitting one person into three actors, but that felt very right to us for this. It allowed us to really make it different from the movie and the book, which felt right. And just having those three women and those three men in the three different time periods just allowed me to make it a play, really, and to figure out how to interweave the time periods and juxtapose the time periods. And early on, my work was just sort of like the dramaturgical, like, what is the structure of this? How are we going to see these three timelines play out in a way that's hopefully emotional and clear and satisfying? So I started out with like the bones, you know, and deciding when the big events are happening and sort of like filling in from there. But the challenge is, you know, honoring the source material and also making something new. And that can be scary because we love the movie, we love the book, and we also want to do something different. So how do we do all those? How do we honor what we love and do something new? And give the fans their moments and honor those fans and like honor the fact that people are coming to see the Notebook, the musical, because they love the movie, and, you know, wanting to give them that experience, but also give them something more and something new.
Writing a book for a musical is really hard because the music eats up so much of the story and the time, literally, of the musical. And, you know, Becca is still continuing to perfect a scene that kind of it runs into these two song moments that are like the big moments for the characters. And so she said to me, she's like, I have to get all this information into this scene, but I can't rob the song of the song, because the song is where the big revelations come from. But you also want to have some of that lead up and that information in the scene. And so that's a real, from my vantage point, a near to impossible task that Becca does.
Yeah, the other day you said, sorry, I'm sorry for taking all of everything and put it in the song. And I said, no, I mean, that's the point. Mm-hmm. And that's what I actually really love about book writing. It's so humbling and so hard that you're scaffolding, you know, you're just like, here are the steps to get to the song. Everybody's waiting for the song. And I just love the challenge of trying to the best of my ability to make these scenes really lean and emotional, and also get to the song. But I remember feeling, watching my first musicals when I was in high school, when I first saw any sort of musical theater, just wanting them to sing and waiting for them to sing, you know? And you don't always really realize that there even is a book, and that's almost the goal.
Yeah. You've written for TV, Becca. Does the structure of writing for TV, or thinking about structure in the way that people write for TV, did that carry over at all as you were working on this musical or any musical that you've worked on?
Yeah. Yeah. In the sense of economy, just always trying to be efficient. And in the TV writing space, that's more like, we need to get the script down to 48 pages so that we can shoot it in 10 days. It's more so that logic, but it applies to book writing because you just don't have tons of time, and because you need to get to the song. But yeah, there's definitely some parallels there.
Yeah. Yeah. And for you, Ingrid, how would you characterize the sound of The Notebook, and how is it different from the sound of an Ingrid Michaelson song that you would sing yourself in front of an audience?
I think there are definite parallels, because as a writer, I have tendencies to write in certain ways. So there's obviously going to be, you know, things that sound similar to my Ingrid Michaelson solo career music. But I really... With this project, I feel like I wasn't stuck on verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, done, which is the way pop music goes for the most part. You could be tangential. You could write a song that was just a minute long. You could write a song that was spans the whole, in the second act, there's a song that's like 8 minutes long because it's, there's dialogue and there's underscore and there's, you know, there's so many rivulets that go all these different ways. And so I think my melodies are always my melodies. I love a scale. I love a scale running up. I love a scale running down. I love certain motifs that are just very ingritty. But I think with writing for musical theater, at least for this piece, I just gave myself the freedom to let the water flow wherever it wanted to flow, which I also think is really indicative of our story being a memory play and memory sort of washing over you, and how when you remember a memory, you're actually remembering the memory of that memory, and how things aren't always just A, B, A, B, C, B. They're all the letters. And I think I allowed myself to, you know, push the boundary on form of song, which you can in musical theater. I mean, you can in pop music, you might not do very well, but that was the biggest exciting change for me. Sitting and watching the musical is sometimes wonderful and sometimes incredibly painful. I'll explain, whereas when I'm on stage, I have control of the room. I have command of the room. Those people are there to see, those 1,000, 2,000 people are there to see me. They bought a ticket to see me. So I'm already, I know that I'm landing into a soft room. Like, people want to hear my music. Notebook, somebody might not even know, many people don't know that I wrote, don't know who I am. They just know what the Notebook is and they want to see it on Broadway. And so they're being forced to listen to 22 of my songs. So if I'm not their cup of tea, you know, my anxiety meter is quite high. So if somebody's rustling with their cough drops or gets up to go to the bathroom in the middle of a song, you know, it breaks my heart into 1,000 pieces. I'm very fragile. So it's a very different experience. The wonderful part of it is getting to watch these incredible vocalists sing music that I wrote and internalize and metabolize these words and these notes and make the song their own. And that's really exciting to me. And during the whole rehearsal process and development process, that always just, I enjoyed that more than I enjoyed singing the songs myself. Now that we're in the performance side of things, and listen, for the most part, we're getting wonderful feedback, and the audiences seem to really adore and love what they're seeing. But you know, all it takes is one person who you know goes to the bathroom in the middle of Act One during a song, and I think, oh no, I suck, I'm terrible, I hate everybody, I want to go home, I don't want to do this anymore. Yeah, it's been a very, previews have been, well, it's only been 2 weeks, but it's been hard for me, very hard.
I'll have more with Ingrid and Becca right after the break. Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. Welcome back to my conversation with Ingrid Michaelson and Becca Brunstetter, the writers of the new Broadway musical, The Notebook.
I wonder if we can talk a little bit about the casting of the project. Becca, you were mentioning, you know, the idea of splitting up the same, your two main characters are played by three different actors at different stages of their lives. So it's six people total playing two characters. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the thinking behind the casting, because there's clearly no attempt to make them all look the same or anything. Like in some cases, like, you know, a character will be played by a black actor in one time period and a white actor in another time period. And so it's tell me about what was the kind of logic behind this and what that does to how the story is told.
Yeah, definitely. Well, early on, we knew that we wanted to create the opportunity for not just white people to see themselves in this story. Now, we started working on this 7 years ago. So the conversation around diverse casting has changed a lot in 7 years. We've gone from colorblind to color conscious, you know? And so early on, when we were trying to figure out how to not just have white Allie and white Noah, we, you know, wanted to make sure we weren't just like saying Noah's black and being irresponsible about what that actually meant for the character. We wanted to make sure that these actors, whoever we cast, could authentically be themselves in these characters. After developing it for a few years with that in our brains, I think it was around, you know, when Michael and Shelley came on board to direct, that they kind of just gave us permission to just cast these characters however we see fit and create a world in which anyone can see themselves in the show. And because it's a play, because it's a memory play, what we're kind of showing is that these souls are all connected, and you've got three different alleys, but they don't all look the same because, you know, one way you can look at it is like we change as we get older in these different phases of our lives. But they just share the same soul and the same spirit. And what our incredible choreographer, Katie Spellman, has done is over the years, the choreography in the show is really simple, but a lot of her work has been, how can we show that these three very different people are essentially the same person through the way that they carry themselves and their mannerisms? So it's interesting just thinking about the journey over the 7 years, our initial desire, and then the, you know, how do we do this responsibly and what does that even fucking mean, to let's just do it. Let's just do it and hope and pray that people get it. And you know, we're doing our best to make it clear, but I don't know. I mean, I can't speak for everyone. I'm sure Ingrid feels like I'm really, really pleased with where we are now and with the humans we have playing these parts. It's it feels good.
Yeah.
My whole thing has always been, it's theater. People are singing on stage.
Yeah.
If you can come into a theater, sit down and watch people sing and suspend your disbelief that people are singing on stage, I think you can suspend your disbelief that these people who don't look the same are the same person. That's the magic of theater, is we get to be magical. We get to play. And if we have this opportunity to take this beloved story and expand it in a way that people can hopefully see themselves or a fraction of themselves or pieces of themselves on stage, why wouldn't we do that? I think that was always in our mind. It was just, what a beautiful way to show the universality of love and loss and everything in between, because we all feel that in varying degrees. We all go through the things that these two characters, six actors, are doing and are feeling. And to me, it takes this beautiful sort of story that's one unit, and it just busts it open into the heavens, into the multiverse. It's just, I think it's just a wonderful concept that we always wanted. And again, like Becca said, we were afraid, we didn't want to do it wrong. And we definitely did take our time and spoke to a lot of people and tried to figure out the best way to do it. But I think ultimately it's just a story about humanity.
The names Michael and Shelley were mentioned. Those are the directors, Michael Greif and Shelley Williams. And it is not all that common to get a show with a new Broadway musical with two directors attached. How did that come about? And how have you both found having two directorial voices in the room has served your work and served the piece?
I've never had an experience with one director, really. So I don't really know what to compare it to. So Becca can probably share that. But Michael was on first. We hired him pretty early on. And in 2020, when the world was in revolution and the and we were all at home and we were all trying to figure out how to be better humans, I remember Michael talking to Becca and I and saying, I really want to bring somebody else on, and I have someone in mind. But he was very secretive. Do you remember, Becca? He was so careful with everything. He said, I really feel like we need another voice in this room, in this space. And soon he revealed it was Shelley, and we had a meeting, we all talked, and it was like, I don't know, it felt like stars were aligning, and we all just saw the story similarly, but from perfectly different points of view, if that makes any sense. And it's been nothing but lovely. I have nothing to compare it to, and I'm kind of afraid of stepping into a new project because I don't know what that's going to mean and what that's going to look like, what that's going to feel like, because this project has been so, for lack of a better word, familial. And they definitely are a unit. There's no pitting one against the other. They come as a package deal. You know what I mean? Like they have their own sort of interactions that they do sort of off camera, so to speak. And they come to us fully formed. But it is really wonderful to have multiple points of view, and everyone listens to everyone. Everyone is kind and respectful. And I think because they have a 25-year friendship, and care and respect for each other, it's very vast, their respect for each other, that it just, you know, it was really just, it just felt like a wonderful, wonderful team that we had, that we started to build. And when Shelley came on, it started to really feel like, oh, this is it. Like now we're really rolling, you know? But Becca, I can't speak to what is it like to have one director. I don't know.
Well, I actually think that Ryan Vasquez, who plays Middle Noah, he said this in an interview the other day, and it was so on point. So I'll just regurgitate what he said, which is that the two director thing, which I also have not experienced before, creates this spirit of collaboration and discussion that kind of takes away from how an actor or even perhaps a writer or a composer would sometimes feel, that you're sort of being like told where to stand or told what to write. Or it really, because there's two directors, we're just constantly in conversation. Do we like this? Is that the right choice? Or, you know, do we, what about this? What about that? Constant discussion, constant collaboration. And, even more than there would be if there were just one, I think, which has been really nice. And they really just complement each other really well. Michael, like early on, he's made so many musicals. He's so good with structure and was so prescriptive with us, telling us this scene should go here, this song should go here. Really that kind of bird's eye view structure help that we really, really needed. And Shelley is just so emotionally connected to the actors and the characters that she's able to just help us talk through, you know, what's going on with a character, what's going on with an actor. She's just, so do you see how those two things really just speak to each other? It's really beautiful. Yeah. I'm kind of always in awe of it.
Mm. Yeah. So let's talk about that rain in the show. Have you felt the rain? Is the water cold? Is it warm? Do the actors talk about shivering? Like, what?
You know, I've never felt it. I don't know if I'm even allowed. There's so many rules and, you know.
We got to get up there. This is a good idea.
I know.
I can't believe that we haven't.
This would be a good TikTok, you know, you and me.
Yeah, that's true.
Dancing in the, I'll pick you up. We'll swing you around.
I feel like maybe I should pick you up, okay. You being the smaller person.
Was the rain non-negotiable? Did you know going in that there was going to be onstage rain in this show? Just because so many people. I mean, this was my first exposure to the full story of The Notebook, and yet all I could think of was, you know, Ryan Gosling picking up Rachel McAdams in the rain. Like, so did you know that was like, oh, we definitely have to have that moment, and there's definitely going to be actual rain on stage? Was that always part of the concept?
I think we always knew there was going to be rain, but there's ways of doing rain without actually rain. Mm-hmm. Angels in America did a really interesting thing where they had these little tiny white plastic balls that fell, and the way they bounced off the ground, it really looked like rain, but it was a sort of an abstract take on rain. You know, there are other ways that you can do it. So I didn't know we were 100% going to have real rain. Until probably like right pre-Chicago, when they were really talking about the rain rig, I said, oh, okay, we're really getting the rain. It's exciting. But yeah, the rain's always been, that's such a moment, you know, but we're always so like, we don't want people to clap for the rain, you know, I don't want to have spoiler alerts. We didn't want to mimic exactly what happened in the movie in the rain. That's kind of been, I think, our go-to hope this whole way through is like, like Becca said earlier, we want to echo these iconic moments, but we want to turn them on their head a little bit, so that we are giving people ultimately these, you know, these nuggets of the story, but we're telling it through our own way. So yeah, we definitely have the lift in the rain as indicated by press photos. So that's not giving anything away.
No. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was thinking about this last week. The rain. Yeah. If you've never seen the movie, the rain is the moment. The rain is the moment. And it's the moment that the fans of the movie are waiting for. It feels really good to give people that moment, that iconic moment from the movie. But that moment in our musical is not until act two. So we do, you know, we're asking these super fans to wait until act two for this moment, in the same way that you wait till three quarters through the movie, probably, for that moment. But it's kind of daring and scary in a way, you know, to hold off. There's this other iconic moment in the movie where Noah is hanging on a Ferris wheel. At the fair, asking her out, like, I'm gonna fall off this Ferris wheel and die if you don't say you'll go out with me. It's a great moment. But for example, like, we're not gonna try and do that. We're not gonna put a weird fake Ferris wheel seat on stage, and you know, it feels good to have chosen the rain as a gift to the fans. But yeah, it's not exactly like the movie, and our hope and dream is to like give that gift, but also do something a little different and challenge the audience to an even like slightly expanded version of the story.
And it's also just really beautiful, you know, and Allie's character is a watercolor painter. That's how she makes, you know, in the book, she becomes very successful. So she's a successful painter, and we have a water projection. We have a pool. The rain is another, obviously, water. So there's something just so lovely that our show is just surrounded by water. And to me, water also evokes memory. You know, it just, there's something very circular about the whole thing. And it is just gorgeous to look at. And the way Ben, our lighting person, Ben Stanton and team have lit, it's just gorgeous to look at. I mean, when we first saw the rain come down, it was very impressive for all of us, and we all were just standing there with our mouths agape, you know, staring at it. It's magical, and that's a moment that I think if I were like a young person coming to theater, or even, you know, any age, I guess, that would really just hit me. You know, I would remember that. I would feel that. I would remember seeing that, and you can smell the water in the space. Like, there's just something really tangible and visceral about having actual rain on stage that I think is really magical. But it's not magical. It's really technical, and there's a lot that goes into it. Oh my goodness, there's a lot that goes into it. In Chicago, we had to have people squeegeeing up water during a scene because people were slip sliding all over the stage. So our amazing set designers figured out how to make the stage not slippery, how to have little runners that guide the water into the pool. Like, I don't even know what they did, but knock on wood, we've had a pretty slip-free few weeks. The key is to make it look effortless when it is effortful.
I will tell you, I did notice watching the show. I thought, wait, no one ever came out and wiped up that water. They must have done put some serious work into figuring out how to get rid of that water, because
they did in Chicago. Yes.
If you wanted, it was like a squeegee ballet, basically. It wasn't.
Sure.
But, they were all dressed in black in an attempt to be hidden. And every night we were just like, oh my God, this is awful. They're just eight people squeegeeing for their life, trying to push this water off stage.
But it was still worth it. Like, because you got to give people the moment. I think we kind of weirdly got away with it in Chicago because it's so beautiful. And then what's happening between the characters, you've been longing for this for so long. So at least I think while they're squeegeeing, you're still hopefully riding the high of the moment you just saw and forgiving it.
And Becca had a really funny scene happening downstage in the front too, in an attempt to distract from the squeegee ballet.
That was Michael and Shelley asking me, could you write something to cover the squeegees? And I was like, sure.
And it stayed. Yeah. But the thing is, it's lasted because it's a really funny part of it's. I think one of the things that Becca and I said I think I said it two nights ago to you, Becca. I was like, it's an Ingrid Becca combo where you hit him with a really sad song and then a hysterical, few book scene right after it. It's the juxtaposition of the sadness to the laughter is so important because people laugh even harder when they feel that sadness, and they feel even sadder when they laugh. Like it's sort of like stretching the audience's ability to feel emotion in both ways. And I think that Becca and I toggle those worlds so perfectly that we really just keep people on a constant back and forth until the end, where it's just pretty sad, but hopefully ultimately somewhat hopeful and peaceful at the end. I think that's something. So that little squeegee ballet monologue that lasted because it's so funny, and it happens after a really sad song, and the audience just needs that. They need, it's like food. They need that moment of laughter, that moment of levity, which then sets up the next moment of sorrow so well.
Yeah. The Notebook is now in previews. What's next for you both?
Oh my goodness. I'm working on a solo record that I'm going to put out in the summer. So I'm very excited about that. That's what's next for me.
Yeah, cool. And Becca?
I always have some pilots in development. Mm-hmm. And I have another play that starts rehearsal 2 days before we open down at Playmakers Rep, where I went to college. And I want to do more musicals.
That was my next question. That was going to be my last question. Tell me, do you want to do more musicals?
Oh, absolutely. We are sort of opening our hearts and minds to see what's next, and hopefully find something else to do together. Maybe we can say this, Ingrid. We want to do a Christmas movie together.
Oh, yes. We both love Christmas. Desperately.
We've always wanted to do a Christmas movie together. So that might be the next thing we do to just like scratch our itch of wanting to make things together before we find our next musical.
Because a musical will take another 7 years. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we will look forward to that new musical and that Christmas movie and to the opening of The Notebook in a few weeks. Thank you both. It was great to talk
to you.
Thank you.
That was Ingrid Michelson and Becca Brunstetter, the writers of The Notebook, now playing on Broadway. If you enjoyed this conversation here on Stagecraft, I'd really appreciate it if you took the time to rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. It really does help. Or tell a friend about Stagecraft. Find past episodes and subscribe at all the places you get your pods, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and on the Broadway Podcast Network, a great place to find more theater for your ears. Until next episode, find me on Instagram and Twitter at Gordon B. Cox. You can also check out my newsletter about international theater. It's called Jaques, and it's at gordoncox.substack.com. Thanks for listening, and see you at the theater.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.